Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Morning, Mo.
Morning.
Got my cup of Joe.
So I have a cup. I don't have our famous, but I have our Canadian cup today. Yeah, the other ones are the wash, actually. Yeah.
Tim Hortons is absolutely the best. There is no doubt about that. And every time I cross the border, actually, there are some now in Boston, believe it or not, trying to compete with the stalwart Boston companies, you know.
Dunkin' Donuts, I know that was
Dunkin' has dug in heavily amongst the population, certainly around Needham anyway. Mm-hmm. So I wish Tim Hortons well. Anything to do with hockey is a good thing. And of course, that's where the name came from. Great Leafs player.
That's right.
Unfortunately, died too young. But so, occasionally we don't have a guest. And you and I do these episodes where we talk about what's on our minds from the most recent publication or a recent publication from OE and JBJS. And I thought that what I wanted to do is to look at a article from the perspective of an orthopedic surgeon that really knows very little about the subject. Of course, you and I are both trauma-based, and we've done a lot of work with arthroplasty, et cetera, and pre- and post-operative evaluation of patients, et cetera, but I am not a pediatric orthopedist apart from fractures. I know something about fractures, but I picked an article from the most recent publication of the JBJS, and it is on hip morphology as assessed by MRI for children who have developmental dysplasia of the hip. And this is a cohort study that was done from Children's Hospital in Boston, the center of Dunkin' Donuts, back to our earlier conversation. But what this group did was they used MRI after closed or open reduction of the hip in relatively young children. I think the mean age was about 6 months when the hip was reduced. And then they looked at the measurements on these post-reduction MRIs to see if they could predict residual dysplasia at 10 years later. Now, I don't believe it is standard of care to get MRIs after a closed or open reduction of the hip. So this, in my view, could be, as a non-pediatric orthopedist, could be a paradigm shifting contribution, even though it is a level four contribution. So they did things really, really well methodologically. They did reliability assessments on multiple people measuring the MRIs, and they were blinded to the ultimate outcome with repeat measures. And then they did receiver operator curves and advanced statistical methodology to make sure that the measurement accuracy was there. And basically what they have found is that one particular measurement in the coronal plane, which is the femoral acetabular distance, and they have great diagrams in the manuscript of how to make that measurement, has a high level of predictability in terms of residual dysplasia that would likely need surgical intervention. So to me, this is what staying up with the entire field is all about. I, as somebody who doesn't really manage children with congenital dysplasia of the hip, but I do get questions, from friends, people at church, somebody's sister-in-law, what do we do with this and how do they, and for me, as someone who's perceived to be just an orthopedic surgeon by people outside the field, I feel like there's an advantage for me to have this information and to understand it for when I get those questions. So I wanted to bring it up for our audience, just for them to consider, You know, I think most of us, when we read the journal, we look at the areas of where we practice. But I think there's great value in really looking at least at the abstracts and understand the methodology and the conclusion, because we're going to get these questions from all over our social networks, both in person and in social media. So I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but that was what was on my mind this morning.
Yeah, you know, the thing that that struck me about this was, you know, in general, is that it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it doesn't seem that long ago that, you know, when you would get a copy of, let's say, the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, you would literally go through every paper. Now, it, you know, it could have been earlier in your training where we weren't as, quote, differentiated. But, you know, if we, despite being siloed in your subspecialty, Mark, I have to believe that there's a greater good to at least having a good, you know, knowledge of the big stuff. You know, it's the same reason in many, let's say, you know, even let's say in cardiology, for example, I have lots of colleagues at Mac who are doing these big programs. And even within cardiology, let's say, there's so many subspecialties, but they have what's called the late breaking news session where everyone attends. It's like a public forum where this is what everyone should know, you know, at a principle. You should know this. You should have awareness of this. And I think we get it from different sources. I think the challenge we face, and you hear all the time from trainees and early career surgeons all the time, is there's just so much more information I have to consume to stay on top of my own subspecialty. How do I, how do I stay abreast of everything? It used to be, and I think it still should be, that there are places where you should be able to go to get, you know, high quality input. So you're not spending all your time looking at all the subspecialty journals. And I think that gets back to the importance of having a journal like the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, like Ortho Evidence, I would say in the same vein, which is you're bringing, like, all the heavy lifting is being done, right? You know, by others to bring you what they believe is sort of a good representation of high quality, high impact research around the world. Yeah. So from your point, I mean, very similarly, like, it struck me when you had this idea, and I did a similar thing. I just looked at what's been happening, you know, sort of the top 10 read papers in the last month, you know, just what's happening around the world. And I'm happy to share that with you as well, and we can continue the discussion, but fully agree that we need to have places where we have trustworthy information and places where we should be keeping up from areas just outside ourselves for a whole bunch of reasons, like you mentioned.
Yeah. Good. So why don't you show us what you had on your mind here?
Okay. Yeah. So let me just give you a quick view of that. So this is an example, and I hope you can see it here. I'm going to minimize my visual, but basically this just gives you an example of, you know, what across at least the viewership. So there's about maybe 20 or 30,000 views in a typical week on content we have. And if you look at this, you know, you kind of see a mix of things, and it goes from week to week, as we things change, anything from the injectables to issues of leadership to spine to arthroplasty. And you can sort of see osteoarthritis being important and pain control. All these are in ACL work as well, a new update. But here's something I wanted to share with you. When you put out a high impact paper, so there's a recent high impact paper, and I believe we're going to try to get the authors in. So I'm not going to speak about the high impact paper, but just give an example. So when you put out a high impact paper, you know, one that comes out in a top tier publication, but more importantly, it's a large trial. In this particular case, it's a large trauma trial. Look at how quickly like views just around the world change, how quickly they change. It becomes basically, you know, somewhere between over 50% of the views of the whole site is on one high impact study. And if you look at happens before and after, so before in yellow is kind of like this, you know, kind of general trauma reading against this paper. And within 24 hours, the world turns blue. It's like everyone is here, you know, trying to consume what is this information. And I think what this gets down to is that there's lots of areas of interest, and it would be important for all of our members of the orthopedic community to understand the high impact stuff, you know, whether it's published in the journal, whether it's published in other sources, or whether we bring that to you via the journal. All those sorts of things, Mark, to me, are ways in which we should be thinking about the importance of looking at it. Because you can't, you know, the truth of the matter is no one place holds everything. So we've got to find places where we can bring in the best stuff together. But you can see how quickly the world lights up with impact. And so the question is, how do we ensure that our community gets access not only to the impact in their specialty, but across the breadth of subspecialties that's orthopedics?
Right. I think what we've shown with these two illustrations from OE and JBJS is that from the OE side, there is huge value in synthesis of information. Of course, that was the philosophy when you created OE and having a way where information can be pooled so that its impact increases. But from the manuscript I chose, that's the influence of an individual article, which on the whole may change the way children with acetabular dysplasia are managed early on. Now, acetabular dysplasia is probably, and the management of it may not ever be published in the New England Journal of Medicine with a international multi-center RCT. So we have to be cognizant of the whole pyramid of evidence. And there are many, many low incident conditions that, this is the type of analyses and the type of well-done studies that we have to rely on to improve care. There's a huge value across the whole spectrum when high-quality methodologic approaches are used. I'm quite sure you agree with that.
Oh, for sure. And and please don't take the word high impact to those listening in and watching as being only a multinational randomized trial. I mean, impact is this likely to have an influence on the care of patients? Is this likely to change the mindset or right. push sort of the boundaries or any benchmarks in an area? So, and oftentimes it could be as simple as, an initial innovative idea that leads to a case, that leads to a series that ultimately leads to comparative. So we would hope that we would see from this, really well done Boston paper, additional groups looking at the same and trying to test, it in different populations in different settings to say, yeah, listen, we get the same findings. This is exactly it. Because that gets back to the whole Bradford Hill criteria of, the more you can show specificity, the more you can show that this leads to that outcome, not multiple outcomes, the more you can show that in multiple different populations undergoing the same procedures or same issues around the world have the same, findings. That's going to be now the discussion that should be happening. And it's great to see it happening, sooner than later.
Right. Well, I just have one other concept I'd like to discuss with you that kind of bridges what we're talking about here. Many, many decades ago, I was involved with the LEAP trial, which was a cohort study of patients who had limb salvage versus early amputation. That's obviously a subject that's never going to be subject to an RCT. No patient or their family is going to agree to have their limb amputated based on what comes out of the randomization. So that was a very large, relatively speaking, it's kind of a rare condition that the limb that's at risk, about 700 patients where I think 160 had amputations and the remainder had salvage. And lots of subsequent publications out of that I think changed care. It was published in the New England Journal, I think, in the 90s. But do you have a sense at OE, you follow all of the high quality, high influence publications. Do you have a sense what percentage are RCTs versus observational type designs?
Yeah. So, just because at the time it was, we were trying to use the mindset of let's try to catalog every randomized trial. So if it's not a randomized trial or a meta-analysis of a randomized trial, it won't make the site because the site is just about RCTs, of which we have over, just short of 10,500 now. So there's lots.
Yeah.
I don't know what the relative proportion would be because we don't cull them, but I can tell you, there's about 2,000 articles that are potentially searched every month. And of those, somewhere between 75 to 100 make the cut for an RCT. So it's not a, meaning being an RCT or not. So there's a lot of non-RCT, but the preponderance of the information is non-RCT. We've thought often about, and rarely do we do, include large observational studies that we think have an impact. And we make that caveat that this is, we think practice changing, or we think this is a hugely important study that should be shared, but that's usually been the exception, not the rule. That doesn't mean it's right. It just means that we just don't have the bandwidth to add all the observational data sets.
Got it.
Yeah, but well, for sure. Course. Yeah, but for sure, it would be important to, you know, to let folks know that, you know, you can have a level one prognostics study, you can have a level one diagnostic test study, right? So, like, we often, like, if the study is about a treatment or a therapy, yeah, you know, then you go into level one to four for RCT, but a study of prognosis, looking at the outcome or factors associated with something. If it's designed as a prognostic study, Mark, it's a level one, and that's a wood. And then we should be really asking for that. We should definitely be promoting that. We want more level one, prognostic. Because I think people get caught up in the, well, you know, it's just, you know, it's always about a treatment.
Yeah.
But the question isn't always about a treatment.
Right. And of course, when you have a non-randomized protocol, you really have to have very sound methodology to limit bias. And I think the authors of the manuscript that I selected did everything possible to do that. And thus, I think it has great potential for changing care. So, well, thanks for this discussion, Mo. It's always good to hear what's on your mind from OE's perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's always fun to pick something out of a recent article. And it's an unbelievable day here in what's supposed to be the frozen Northwest. We're north of you, I believe, technically.
It's sunny. It's sunny warm. You won't believe this, but I'm wearing shorts right now. I am wearing shorts. I went out to get my coffee in shorts. So, yeah, it's above zero. So that's shorts weather in Canada.
Yeah, there is literally nothing white on the ground anywhere around
sunny.
Where it's crazy.
I know. I can't believe this is February in Canada either. So
yeah. Well, maybe you get around in, huh? Yeah, our golf courses are opening on the weekends. Yeah.
No, ours unfortunately no. Today is just gonna be meetings after meetings, but it's okay. I'm gonna be looking out the window. I'm looking out the window every break.
Well, I hope you suffer the meetings in good spirits. So
I will.
Cheers, and don't forget your Joe.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
Yeah, bye.